Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
We're going to just kind of dive in. We're trying to cover as much ground as we can. We're going to talk about some, we got three or four questions in a row about progesterone. Seems like, you know, we're kind of discussing this morning. It seems like we talk about progesterone all the time. But when we put out content about estrogen and progesterone and thyroid and all these different things. So of course, people are finding that content and we keep getting the same types of questions over and over. So, and honestly, it might seem repetitive to you and I, but I think people just need some of that repetition. And, these are very, I like it. They're very specific questions. And, all the women that tend to find our content, they all say they've been looking for this information. It's really difficult to find.
And hey, I love talking about progesterone, so I have no problem talking about progesterone today.
Yeah, right. Well, I didn't say it was a problem, but to be honest, if there was one thing that we use probably more than anything of women of all different ages, it would have to be, progesterone.
Absolutely. And progesterone, we use that, you're right, all ages, really. Even teenagers, I'll use a little bit of certain types of progesterone with, and 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, postmenopausal, and beyond. And that was one question that somebody asked on, I think on the website, is if it's safe to take and how long can you take it for? And so that was her concern, is she has what her doctor is telling her is high estrogen levels. So to balance out that high estrogen levels, her doctor is saying you should take some progesterone. So her concern was, hey, I don't want to take medication. I understand that less is best. Is it safe to take? How long can I take it? And I thought we could kind of talk a little bit about that question. Then there's some other questions we can also kind of move into as well.
Yeah. It's interesting. She said in that, question, we're not going to read it because it's just about progesterone. There's like three or four, and we're not going to read three or four questions. And we're not going to try to do three or four different episodes because it's all pertaining to the same thing. But they're all, sort of separate questions. But she did say that this is what I find interesting. Like, you and I could go really down the rabbit's hole on that one. She said that her doctor or nurse practitioner was recommending progesterone because of high estrogen. But the woman said in her email that she did not have any symptoms. So what would you deem as a symptom of high estrogen that would deem someone to prescribe progesterone?
Definitely. So when you think about high estrogen, I think about puffiness, easy weight gain, munchy, a little bit emotional, but more with higher estrogen, it's more sad and weepy. So more sad and weepy, where when someone has truly low progesterone, they're more like crabby and grouchy and easily irritated. So that, but, and then kind of swing a little bit more of the rabbit's hole is when you're testing someone for high estrogen, how do we know what her estrogen levels are? If she's a cycling female, her estrogen level is going to be quite different from day 1 to day 10 to day 14 to day 28. That's going to change, throughout the month if she's cycling. And sometimes when I do some blood work on women that are cycling, they're still having their regular periods, and I love to do the blood work all times of the month, because it's interesting to see how that changes with them, is when we do a mid-cycle, right before ovulation, their estrogen is actually pretty high, because that's part of that sort of physiology to encourage ovulation, is right before ovulation, that estradiol, that estrogen will go up, fairly high to encourage that egg to leave the ovary, for ovulation, and then it comes back down. So sometimes when you catch somebody in that mid-cycle, it'll look like their estrogen's high, but it really is just part of that basic 28-day cycle.
Yeah, right. And so when we when we want our patients to do lab work, we usually tell them to go on either day 12 or day 21. Day 12 is the peak of estrogen, which is kind of what you were talking about.
All the time.
Well, right. But I'm just saying, specifically with rhythmic dosing, some of this cycling type of hormone replacement that we do, You know, we'll kind of, you know, it doesn't really matter. You and I can look at the lab test and kind of figure out, you're really good at it. You can really figure out like almost to the day where they are in the cycle, which is, you know, pretty impressive. But usually day 12, day 21, we want to see that high peak of estrogen. But see, that's that kind of brings up some other questions for me. Like, why would the, is the doctor just basing, or the nurse practitioner just basing that on the blood test level? Which you know as well as I do, the blood test of estrogen, let's say it was just day 12. Let's say that number, you can see it anywhere, depending on the age of the woman, right? The woman that sent in the question, she didn't tell us how old she was, but let's say it's anywhere from, you know, 75 to 500. You know, is she, you know, is that number, which is, would be normal anywhere in there, it probably wouldn't be 75 unless she was close to menopause. But if it's 350, 450, 550.
Or, you know, 250.
Yeah, yeah. That'd be normal for most menstruating women to have a really high peak on day 12.
On that mid cycle. But it could be too that, you know, I guess I'm going to go on kind of a little bit of a tangent here. It's, I do balance out higher levels of estrogen because there are lots of women that are estrogen dominant. That's very common. And I do balance that out by giving progesterone. So you can kind of soften some of those estrogen dominant symptoms. But like you were saying, perhaps that patient or that person isn't having any symptoms. So then technically, like, what do you want to do there? My thought goes to, well, higher levels of estrogen. And estrogen isn't a bad hormone. Estrogen is like the best hormone in the world, but estrogen isn't bad. It's the estrogen metabolites that have to be pushed out of the system, metabolized out of the system. So you utilize the estrogen. Those metabolites have to go out of the system. So one thing that I'll do instead of doing actual medication on that is to try to bring down those, or kind of, I guess, utilize the efficiency of getting those estrogen metabolites out of the system, because those metabolites can have further effect downstream on, you know, breast tissue. And a lot of times that creates a lot of those estrogen dominant symptoms. So we'll do.
So I asked you earlier, so estrogen dominant symptoms from a pathology perspective. So what would that be?
You mean not so much like the weight gain, the munchiness, the puffiness?
Yeah, those are kind of like the common things that all women have to deal with. But from a truly estrogen dominant perspective, what does that profile look like?
Well, I would say when you're saying from more of a pathology perspective, my thoughts, granted, there's family history, personal history, and all that jazz. But you think about, you know, estrogen metabolites can have an effect on the breast tissue. So that can create proliferation. So we want to protect the breast tissue. That would be one thing that we'd want to work on if somebody had higher levels of estrogen or they were estrogen dominant. And also being estrogen dominant, if they still have a uterus, does proliferate that uterine lining and cause thickening the lining, fibroids, can further exacerbate endometriosis.
Okay, so that's what I was trying to get at, was the endometriosis and fibroids.
Yeah, uterine lining, yeah, cysts.
Yeah, yeah, right. So there's a lot of things that can kind of go wrong when it's sort of extreme. But to say a woman is estrogen dominant when she has no symptoms, then she's not really estrogen dominant.
Well, then you might say, well, hey, you know, let's look at your family history. Let's look at some personal history. Let's, you know, take in all the variables. And then instead of maybe jumping into progesterone or a prescription, like I said, utilizing something like DIM, which is diindolmethane long supercalifragilisticexpialidocious word.
Diindolmethane. Yeah, DIM. A lot of women have heard of DIM. Yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, derived from cruciferous vegetables, just as, you know, what's the other one? The I3 indolcarbinol.
Indole-3-carbinol. Yeah,
that's so awesome. That also, as well, is a great way to help downregulate or utilize the efficiency of getting that estrogen metabolites out of the system. But it's a beautiful, innocuous, safe, you know, supplement that you can take. So I would say in this case, for this patient that says, you know, I'm not really having any of those symptoms, but I am estrogen dominant, just a simple DIM, DIM, and that 3-indolcarbinol would be a nice, you know, just a nice foundation to start with.
Right, right, right. Well, I just found it interesting that the nurse practitioner wants to prescribe the progesterone, but doesn't have any estrogen dominant symptoms. So what would be then symptoms of progesterone? You know, this is kind of a mixed question. I'm setting you up here, but what would be the symptoms of low progesterone then on the flip side of that?
Because I do think a lot of times people will mistake estrogen dominance for actual progesterone insufficiency. And I'm really kind of, you know, mincing words here, or maybe splitting, what do they say, splitting a hair, you know, maybe being a little bit too focused is, but I do find when women make pretty good estrogen, because like I said, estrogen is a great hormone, but they aren't making enough progesterone, which is common, whether it's due to lifestyle, stress, genetics, whatnot, is when they make less progesterone, and I consider that progesterone insufficiency, is like I said, they're more crabby, grouchy, easily irritated. They have trouble sleeping, more so trouble staying asleep.
I think we need to check your progesterone.
progesterone is good. Although I am 49 now.
It's amazing. Hey, it's amazing that we're almost 50. Jesus.
I know, but hey. Jesus. It only gets better, right?
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm almost 50, do you?
No, my patient the other day asked me how old I was because we've known each other forever. And I said, 49. She goes, you're almost 50. And I said, yep, and I can't wait. I can't wait.
Yeah. So like you said, there's a couple of ways to look at that. Estrogen dominance versus progesterone insufficiency. With your book that you just wrote, the Perimenopause Plan, in some ways, that's kind of our definition, so to speak, is a woman is officially going into perimenopause when that progesterone level starts to drop.
And you know, that nurse practitioner probably has some concerns, like I was saying, about being estrogen dominant. You want to, you know, make sure that, you know, breast tissue is healthy, minimize proliferation. Perhaps this patient has a uterus, so you want to minimize proliferation in the uterus or potential for polyps or fibroids or cysts. And sometimes, you know, hey, a lot of docs don't, I mean, I try to spend a lot of time with my patients because I love them, but, you know, a lot of docs are really, you know, scarce for time, that maybe this person doesn't realize, hey, I'm kind of puffy and munchy because my estrogen's high, or you know, my breasts keep getting bigger and bigger because my estrogen's, you know, I'm estrogen dominant, or maybe my weepiness and kind of, you know, depression is a very black hole, you know, everybody throws things in there. So I wouldn't label it that, but it's more like with estrogen dominant, like a melancholy, my melancholy, nostalgia, sadness, weepiness, you know, crying at commercials that are really sad. Maybe that's part of my estrogen dominance. So it might not be that they had that conversation to really extrapolate and find out, you know, is she really having symptoms? And I'll tell you, I mean, I love that everybody's finding us on the internet. The internet's amazing, but you still got to be careful about what information you find on there.
Oh yeah. I find it even the things that I look for online, you get a very
exercise equipment.
Yeah, you get a very superficial level of information that doesn't answer any questions whatsoever, and then you get a little bit more elaborate information that may not really be true whatsoever. So to everyone out there, I mean, this is kind of par for the course, but if you're out there doing your research, quote unquote, you have to take everything you read sort of with a grain of salt. And true research is not looking at one or two articles and forming an opinion. It's looking at everything that supports your question and that negates your question, and then sort of forming your own opinion based on that, which can be, when you don't have the background information about something, that can be really, really hard to do. It can be hard to do when you do have the background information because like research, like actual research, the literature, like doctors always talk about, I think they talk about it a little too much, because I think research fundamentally is sort of skewed right from the get-go. Because why is research done? I remember I used to teach some nutritionists as part of like a little group that I had. And I used to ask them all the time, because we would look at research. We would talk about studies. We would talk about certain things. I said, why is research done? And they'd be like, you know, okay, to push science forward and to gain knowledge. I said, no. All research is done for money and profit. Once you realize that every research study that has ever been done, in some way, somebody is making money off of that in some capacity. Otherwise, they wouldn't spend the money. So when you look at research from that standpoint, you have to look at it with a very cynical, kind of sort of skeptical, viewpoint. And then make sure that you look at lots of different studies to be able to formulate your opinion. Because if you just look at one or two studies, you can find 100 studies that says, you know, whatever you're looking for to support it. And you can find 100 studies that, you know, that are the opposite of what you're looking for. And most people don't realize that, because they've even honestly, I think even doctors, they read headlines and they read abstracts and they don't take the time to actually read any research. And then you get this, you know, kind of skewed, you know, like you're talking about estrogen. question. So you kind of went down like the proliferation of the breast tissue and the uterine tissue. There's this collective fear when it comes to female hormones. Why is that, right? Like you said, female hormones are what make women women, allows women to have babies and do all these amazing things. But for some reason, we're sort of afraid of them at the same time. It's just sort of weird to me.
No, I agree. Like I was saying, I do appreciate this this listener, I think, or actually I think she was a blog reader, reaching out to us on the internet. The internet can be such an amazing source, but at the same time, I think, you know, maybe having a further conversation with her nurse practitioner or, you know, her practitioner would probably warrant why she would need the progesterone. And then that would put her at ease for it. Cause I have a lot of patients that, hey, their blood work comes in, they are hypothyroid and they may be hesitant to be on medication. Cause hey, I understand that. I'm not a big medication person either. But when you have that conversation with someone on, you know, this is what this means, this is what this might mean for the future, and then kind of having that co-collaboration, then they might feel comfortable. I'd say with this person writing in her question, I wouldn't necessarily start with progesterone unless she was having overt symptoms
So what are those overt symptoms of, why would you specifically, not the nurse practitioner, but why would you give a woman progesterone?
Well, I would say if she's cycling and she's having very heavy periods to the point that perhaps it's even going into anemia or iron deficiency, yeah, that progesterone is going to help thin that lining, lessen those periods, and then prevent her from becoming anemic, where the DIM and the 3-indol carbinol is great for the estrogen metabolites, but it's probably not going to do anything for that. Then I might say if she's having, you know, on her mammogram, there's intense density, or she's having a lot of breast pain or breast growth, or there might even, you know, be some personal history of some breast issues. I might say, you know, we might want to jump a little higher on that level of intervention, because that's what you're always doing as a practitioner, is you're practicing on a level of intervention. Lowest intervention first, and then you work your way up to the top, which could be surgery. You never jump to the top. I don't think that's appropriate. So you start low and work your way up. But depending on what her, you know, what we're seeing as presentation decides where the intervention you want to start. So let's say she's not having any of those things. Then you think, okay, well, are you gaining weight easily? Are you munchy for no reason? Are you super hungry? A lot of times with estrogen dominance, and I don't want to minimize this or kind of blanket statement, but just kind of like an outside perspective on understanding it. It is kind of like a 13-year-old girl, you know, when they're first getting their periods, their progesterone is usually low. They're making a lot of estrone really while their bodies are trying to understand how to cycle. So they're, you know, kind of moody and weepy, also a little defensive, maybe even some breakouts, and they always have, you know, maybe a little pudgy or a little muffin top because their body is trying to get used to these extra hormones. They're growing breast tissue. They're getting it. A lot of times when you're first getting your periods, their periods could be heavy. They could be missing them. They could be, you know, a lot of spotting. So it's kind of a little bit on that picture. And then, you know, I always laugh with my perimenopausal patients and they're like, yeah, I'm like a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, right. So the mom, so you're kind of referring to the different ends, and I know we've talked about this before, but you know, the young teenager and the, you know, 40-year-old, mid 40-year-old mom are sort of in the same hormonal situation a little bit, which is why they don't realize it, but that's why they're butting heads so much.
Yeah, they kind of actually have a little bit of the same hormonal balance, and then so it's just kind of funny. So then we laugh about, you know, the other families in the household perhaps hiding or running off.
Yeah. The sons and the husbands are like, you know, they're going to,
what's going on?
Yeah. What's going on? Yeah. They're like, you know, all panicked. And it's interesting too. Like I hear from a lot of, when we talk about progesterone specifically, the word that comes up all the time is I'm so irritable all the time. That is like the word, like you hear the word irritable. Oh, yep. They need some progesterone. You know, that emotional pendulum swings from one minute they're crying to the next minute they want to strangle somebody. The progesterone does a really nice job of kind of mellowing that out. So that pendulum swing is not quite so much.
Yeah. And also depends on dose too. There's so many different doses of progesterone and so many dosages, ways of taking it. You know, there's so many things there, but like I said, in somebody that might be a little bit more hesitant, you know, this person writing in doesn't necessarily have to, I have to take the progesterone tomorrow. Give it a few months. Like I said, try the DIM, the Threonodal Carbinol. There's other Vitex, Chase, what's the common name? Chase Tree Berry Vitex. That's another one that's really, really safe and innocuous. It helps when you take it, it stimulates luteinizing hormone, which is a hormone from the pituitary that then can further stimulate progesterone from the ovaries. So that could possibly be a start as well. You know, like I said, you want to start at an intervention that's appropriate, but then also, you know, feels comfortable for that patient. So I would say, and there's so many other herbs and other supplements and amino acids that also help support hormones that might be, you know, an option first before jumping into that progesterone.
Yeah. But at the same time though, you're being very kind of, you know, bioidentical progesterone is a very safe hormone.
And progesterone's awesome.
It's really easy just to dive right into progesterone. Now, dosing might be an issue. You can go all the way down to 5, 10, 15, 25 milligrams, all the way up to 200. We don't usually go anything higher than 200.
I just don't find that. I know some other practitioners do. I just don't find that in my practice.
It's kind of like the law of diminishing returns. The higher you go, you're not going to get really any additional benefit. If you're up to 200 milligrams of, you know, again, sustained release bioidentical progesterone is not the same thing as Prometrium. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people, even the doctors might assume that it's the same thing. Prometrium is a commercial prescription. They use peanut oil as part of the formulation, and it's an instant release. You know, in our experience, a lot of women don't tolerate that very well. That's not the same thing as getting bioidentical progesterone, sustained release progesterone from a compounding pharmacy. The response of the woman is quite a bit different in that respect.
And that leads to another couple of questions we got. A listener was mentioning she had taken Prometrium, did some a progesterone troche, and was still having a lot of trouble with digestive issues like diarrhea and some GI issues, and was mentioning which oral progesterone is really nice to sleep. Taking oral progesterone at night, you never want to usually take it in the morning because it can make you a little relaxed, it's great for sleep. It can help reduce down cortisol, raise up GABA. It's, you know, and I think that's in part why it helps with that irritability. But so it was helping with her sleep, but the GI symptoms, I mean, nobody wants to have that. And we were talking about it a little bit and saying, you know, even different compounding pharmacies, and we work with a lot of really lovely compounding pharmacies, you know, amazing people, they still do things differently. Each pharmacy can be a little bit different in terms of what fillers and binders and excipients. And for sure, like Dr. Mackey was saying with Prometrium, anybody that really has like a peanut allergy may want to avoid it, because I know in certain forms they'll put peanut oil in there. Other pharmacies will use lactose, just different fillers and binders. So really I would say, instead of, you know, throwing the progesterone away, is look at what the actual filler is first to see if you might be sensitive to that.
Yeah, I've seen it a few different times. A few different people had problems with progesterone and come to find out the compounding pharmacy was using lactose as their main filling agent or excipient for the progesterone capsules. And there's a difference between progesterone cream and progesterone capsules. We, in these kind of circumstances that we're talking about now, we're pretty much talking specifically about progesterone capsules.
I can say with creams, I've had people on, you know, estrogen, bioidentical and estrogen creams, bioidentical progesterone creams, and they have a reaction to it because people are sensitive. And then we go back and they use more of a hypoallergenic base, or they use a different base, or what you're applying vaginally would be a completely different base than what you're applying topically on your skin rather than a mucous membrane. So there's so many, you know, I would say instead of, like I said, scrapping it, they went to a troche that might have some of the same fillers and binders that, you know, the Prometrium she was on. So you're right. It's not, we're talking specifically about progesterone, but I will say in terms of personal reactions or sensitivities, it can be anything.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, just like with everything, there's going to be 80% that are the average, right? Then you have 10% that are outliers in either direction, whether that's dose, whether that is, like you said, the excipients or the binders they use. So you have this very, the majority of women, like we said earlier, Progesterone, we use it all the time, right? All the time. We've used it thousands and thousands of times, and it's very well tolerated for most women. But you have your outliers in either direction, and that's with anything, not just progesterone, but, you know, nutrients and herbs and vitamins and, you know, thyroid and all these different things. You're going to have that 10% on either side that is going to be sometimes a little bit of a head scratcher. Like, it takes a little bit of a, now, granted, you and I have been doing this a long time, so we're sort of fairly good at spotting them, and we're trying to make sure that we're preventing some of those things so they, one, have a good experience and they don't have an adverse response. Because, I mean, honestly, you're starting a prescription for the first time and you have a negative response right away, yeah, you're going to be a little averse to either continue it or, you know, coming back around, you might like, well, you know, that wasn't so good. You know, so like the one, like I said, about the GI issues, maybe it's the dose, right? Maybe they just need a lower dose. Permetrium, right? It only comes in two doses. It's 100 milligrams or 200 milligrams. And that is, you know, 200 milligrams is really high. So maybe for that person, they need to be started at a lower dose and then just titrate it up, you know, as your body acclimates to it, which we've done that many times as well, too.
I'm going to make it more complicated because you're absolutely right. I was just thinking about dosage. So Permetrium, you know, 100 milligrams or 200 milligrams, that might be too high for her. Because progesterone, a lot of women, so think about, you know, menstruating women. So I don't know if this woman is menstruating or not, is progesterone can be a little relaxing that a number of women will notice they get a little bit of loose stools right before their period. And that's usually because that progesterone changes even during their period because of some hormonal changes. So it could just be the dose is too high that you need to back off, or that Permetrium is instant release. Now, Dr. Mackey was mentioning about sustained release progesterone oral capsules. That is a compound. That's not necessarily something you're going to find at your big box pharmacy, but Permetrium is an instant release. So it goes right into your system, which isn't bad to help somebody fall asleep. But if it's going right into your system at 100 milligrams, that might be just a little too stimulating for her GI system. Or doing a sustained release, maybe even like a 50 milligram. That's good for sleep, or 75 milligram. Geez, with a compounding pharmacy, you can do 80, you can do any microgram, milligram you want to, that might be an option to kind of dial back. Because it was a sweet question saying, you know, my doctor doesn't really know what to do from here. And that's understandable. So, you know, they're not really sure what direction to go in is. I would say perhaps, using a compounding pharmacy, switching it to a sustained release. Because like also in that comment, you know, we've also talked about this too, is that she had done the troche, which is supposed to be sublingual, but part of it does go into the digestive system because you can't help that when you're putting something under your tongue, letting it dissolve, it's going to go down your throat too. So that was probably a little too stimulating for her GI system. But we've always said before is the progesterone creams are great for certain circumstances and certain symptoms, but it's not great for sleep.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, it doesn't really have that. The kind of the broad reaching effect that the oral progesterone does. I think that might have been one of the comment we got was actually on that progesterone cream versus capsules, which was a blog post or a podcast. I think we did a blog post and a podcast on that. You know, so there's always this debate, you know, and honestly, I would say for you and I, probably minus the rhythmic dosing crowd, right? We almost exclusively use progesterone capsules if they have a uterus and they're taking estrogen. If they're taking estrogen for sure, and they're on some kind of a static dosing, same dose every day, rhythmic dosing, we want to encourage a period. So we use progesterone cream there because it doesn't, you know,
maybe you could back up and explain for people that don't know what rhythmic dosing is in menopause.
Yeah, right. So that rhythmic dosing is specifically a menopausal treatment. So once a woman has either had a hysterectomy, so they're in surgical menopause, or they're actually in menopause or the transition into menopause, you know, hot flashes, night sweats, insomnia, the classic menopausal symptoms, we will do rhythmic dosing, which is basically intended to kind of replicate the female cycle. So like what you're talking about earlier, the 28 days, you know, day one, day 12, day 14, day 21, we're trying to replicate those hormonal peaks. And then at the end of the 28 days or close to it, a woman's going to have a period. So in that context, we are using progesterone cream because we don't want to inhibit the growth of the uterine lining, where in static dosing, same dose every day, we don't want there to be any bleeding there. So it's, you know, it's In the static dosing, it's usually always progesterone capsules. In rhythmic dosing, it's almost always progesterone cream. That's really the only difference that we usually decide. I mean, do you use progesterone cream, much outside of rhythmic dosing?
No. Oh, well, I mean, yes. I mean, yes. So not for menopause. I'll use the cream for sometimes perimenopause, but even before that, I'll use it for teenage gals or in their college years for irregular periods. It can be really helpful. I've used it for a polycystic ovarian syndrome to kind of balance out some of the androgens that are there. I've even used the progesterone for women because it can, in some ways I've noticed a handful of women actually helps with their mood. And so they take it in the morning.
The progesterone cream.
The cream helps with the mood. And because it doesn't make you sleepy like taking a progesterone oral, then I can use the cream during the day so they can put it on in the morning to kind of help. So I'm probably complicating it even more, but I will say there are so many ways to use hormones and so many different doses so like I said, I'm probably complicating it.
Well, but yeah.
My answer to your question is yes, I do use progesterone creams.
Okay, but you don't use it, and I know you use it. I certainly do as well, but not as much as you use the progesterone capsules. That was my question.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I do feel like the progesterone capsules I think this has to do with females. There's a lot of women trouble staying asleep at night, feeling irritable, periods are heavy, fibroids. It's just so nice, and it's really a nice start because that when someone's in their 40s, that perimenopause when the hormones are changing, it's usually that progesterone that starts to change first, and then the estrogen shortly follows, and then you have menopause. So I definitely use the progesterone capsules a lot.
Yeah,
and so, I do the sustained release. Probably the majority of the time because it helps them stay asleep. But I do have a few people that I do the instant release because it helps everybody metabolizes things different. So when I do the blood work, sometimes I can tell if that sustained release might be bleeding into the morning a little bit too late. And then I can either change the dose or switch it to an instant. So there's so, like I said, I'm complicating it again. There's so many ways to do the hormones.
Yeah. But that's the benefit to the patient. This is sort of what makes it complicated and why in hormone replacement in general, there's no real right answer, right? There's not one, if you go to the doctor, you got blood pressure. Okay. There's going to be every doctor you go to, there's going to be about 3 or 4 drugs that they're going to use. You got a cholesterol issue, which that's a whole nother topic. I'm not a big fan of cholesterol medication because I think they're focusing on the wrong thing as far as cholesterol goes. But if you go to, 20 different doctors, they're going to give you some type of a statin drug of some sort, right? When it comes to what we're talking about, oh my God, I mean, there's no real right or no, there's some wrong things that you and I see all the time that doesn't make any sense. But even them sometimes, as long as the patient gets some benefit, that's really at the end of the day what it's about. As long as it's safe for the patient and they get some benefit, then that means whatever the practitioner did or prescribed is okay. Now we see some things that we don't really agree with sometimes and could be potentially dangerous. That's not so good for the patient and that needs to be adjusted and changed. That's where I think a lot of the confusion and why hormone replacement is so I wouldn't say random, but just so different from a practitioner to a practitioner because there is no flow chart to follow. That's where the art part of hormone replacement comes in because literally there's unlimited options for a woman's symptom picture and what she's dealing with and being able to navigate that. That's why I think compounding pharmacies are there for the doctor's benefit and for the patient's benefit. So that way you can tailor your prescription, whatever that is, thyroid, progesterone, estrogen, maybe something that you just thought you saw some research and hey, you go to your pharmacist and say, hey, can you do this for me? And they'll be like, okay, let me figure it out and I'll get back to you. You can't do that at Walgreens. You can't do that at CVS, right? A doctor usually when it comes to commercial prescriptions is given 3 or 4 doses and that's it. When it comes to hormones, that's sort of ridiculous. I mean, trying to navigate that and trying to find the right dose when you only have 3 options. I mean, that's really challenging to do. So I think it's a blessing. People don't realize enough. I don't think even doctors realize enough, how much of a benefit that having a good compounding pharmacy is for both the practitioner and for the patient.
I absolutely agree. 100%.
Yeah. So, you know, and now that also, you know, the same thing there too. Not all compounding pharmacies are created equal, right? So there's there's quite a bit of difference from one to the next and how they do things and, you know, how innovative their pharmacists are and how they come up with their different formulations and recipes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We won't need to get into compounding pharmacy. I know enough to be dangerous there, but that's why having a good compounding pharmacy at your disposal. I mean, honestly, how many times do we call in prescriptions to big box pharmacies? Hardly ever.
I mean, there's a few prescriptions, but yeah, when we're doing, well, with the bioidentical hormone replacement, never.
Yeah, none. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe a little bit with like things like Armour or some of the thyroids.
Spironolactone.
Spironolactone. But honestly, the list is really short. We do sort of try to avoid them.
Not on purpose. We're not avoiding them. It's just, everybody has their way of practicing and that just doesn't really fit into the way we practice.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I don't mean we intentionally avoid them, but they just don't have a lot to offer as far as us or our patients and how we like to do things that actually, you know, because at the end of the day, it's about the patient's results. It's about how they respond to the treatment. That's what dictates, having multiple options sort of is a little overwhelming when you're trying to figure some of those things out. But once you have them figured out, then there are so many possibilities any kind of problem or situation or disease, there's always some kind of a treatment. And I see it all the time conventionally, like, oh, well, there's no treatment for that. Oh, well, what do you mean? There's just no drug that has been formulated specifically for that. It doesn't mean that there's no treatment for it. And I think that a lot of people and even physicians, even certainly at big institutions, they get a little nearsighted. They don't realize, or is it farsighted? They don't realize that there's unlimited amount of options. They just need to think beyond just whatever commercial prescriptions available.
Exactly. Or working with the client as not just a human, like as an individual. That's probably what, I think that's what you're really trying to get at, is this person in front of us isn't a cookie cutter, like, here, you'll get this, everybody gets this, everybody gets this. No, we take into consideration, family history, personal history, health goals, what their metrics are. And then you formulate almost like you were saying, like an art, like it's a dance to formulate that plan. And sure, we've been in this biz for a long time, so we've got some experience under our belt. But even for a new practitioner, like I said, starting on the lowest intervention, maybe that might even be just supplements and herbs, and then see how they fare. I'm doing better in this, because nobody ever does perfect. They're like, better in this, but not so good in this. Then you step up on that intervention a little bit. Then you, I always feel like, not that I ever underdose people, but I always like to start slow, because it's much easier to do a little bit less than a little bit more, and then they have symptoms that you have to back out of. So just working your way up that intervention.
Yeah, right. And, we do tend to see people that are very sensitive, and they're sort of, skeptical or afraid of medication. A patient only has to tell you that they're sensitive a few different times to really let that sink in and say, oh, okay, well, maybe we should start a little bit, like you said, start a little bit lower and then just easily kind of titrate up over the course of several days to several weeks to several months. And then now they're actually able to tolerate something, as opposed to just giving a random higher dose and then they have an adverse reaction. If you can avoid that more times than not, and it's okay in that context to be a little conservative, because now that, that potentially, the outliers, the 10% on one side and the 10% on the other side, those are, that individuality is something that needs to be taken into consideration. If you only have three dosage options, you're not really taking their sensitivities into consideration. And I think that happens a lot, which is why those sensitive people tend to make their way to either us or people like us, because sometimes that gets ignored, not necessarily for any, malicious reason. They just have limited options at their disposal. And that's where, that's where it sort of gets complicated. Like, how do you navigate all that? How do you know what's right? At the end of the day, it's really about, how does a patient benefit, and keeping them safe at the same time.
And that's probably what that one, listener was asking about, is probably more sensitive. So the dose was causing the diarrhea, that it really just needed to probably back off on the dose and do the most, cleanest hypoallergenic, you know, fillers that you can use for this patient. Sometimes I've had people react to the capsule because they, you know, they have animal-based capsules and then they have veggie-based capsules, and it could be even be the capsule formulations coming in. The troche, you know, like you said, the fillers and binders. So like you're saying, this is very much individualized, and we do see a lot of sensitive people. And then I also see a lot of people that, you know, you got to really dose them up and hit them with a sledgehammer to get anything to happen. And then they feel great. So everybody is really different when it comes down to this. But I do think with the progesterone, you're right. We use progesterone a lot, that it's great for sleep, that I'm wondering if maybe that nurse practitioner on that other question from the other reader was more about perhaps she may be more progesterone insufficient rather than estrogen dominant, and that's why she's not feeling like she's having those symptoms. Or like you said, there was probably a communication between the practitioner and the client.
Yeah, I just found it was interesting that she said she's estrogen dominant, but the patient says she has no symptoms. Then, in my opinion, the patient wouldn't be estrogen dominant at that point. She's just basing on a lab test. And, you know, if you look at it at whatever certain time, that lab test is sort of, you know, as you know as well as I do, the relationship between estrogen and progesterone it's more about the relationship than the actual numbers themselves. That's where it also gets a little weird, because doctors, you know, practitioners like that, they want things to be very, very logical and very objective. And sometimes it's not so much. So I think we beat the progesterone horse to death right now. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, you and I just to kind of keep rambling on it. You know, this is something that comes up all the time, partially from some of the content we put out, but even with our patients, this progesterone thing is something we use quite often. It's, and even from the first question, she's wondering if she should start it or not. Progesterone is, bioidentical progesterone is a very, very safe hormone to use. You know, just making sure you're getting the dosing right, and you know, those types of things, you can feel confident. And I think there's some protection there that most people don't realize. Now, what does happen, and we'll wrap this up in a second, but what happens, I think, a lot in the hormone replacement is that all hormones get put in the same bucket. And I think that's kind of that's not really ideal, because there are some hormones out there, birth control and different types of the commercial ones, that I think are inherently dangerous. And you can't compare those as being the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. Especially when you're trying to individualize it with someone and you're giving them, you know, something that's so commercial that, you know, somebody that's 200 pounds is getting the same thing as somebody that's 95 pounds. It's just, you know, it's like you said, they're, I do feel like progesterone, I agree too, is very safe. Just like you said, working on that communication, that relationship with your practitioner, and then also the dose. And it's okay to start low and work your way up. I know everyone that comes in, they're just ready for their transformation. They're just ready. I want it to happen tomorrow. Let's make it happen on Monday. But, you know, it's a process, you know, and that process will take a little bit of time, but you'd be surprised at how fast it can go.
Yeah. So I think that we have answered kind of like two or three questions all at once. Certainly, if you have any more questions, you can reach out to us at help@progressorhealth.com. We do get a lot of questions. We appreciate everyone reaching out. We do try to get back to as many as possible, but I keep asking for questions, but it's becoming a little overwhelming. Like, we just can't keep up with all of them.
Read them.
Yeah. We read everyone. We try to, you know, we kind of try to, you know, respond as much as we can, but responding to every individual is almost impossible. So like I said, just bear with us. We still appreciate the interaction and the engagement. So until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.